Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live here on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com after the show on the podcasting platforms, including iTunes and also Podomatic. And a big hello to everybody in the ACR chat room out there on the live stream right now. Hello, everybody. I hope you're all doing well. It's certainly been an eventful week. We're going to break down some of that and more with our next guest. She is an independent journalist. She has been working and doing quite a lot of work in and around Syria in the Middle East now for quite a few years. She has been on the show before. Her name is Eva Bartlett. She's joining me right now on the live link from the Middle East. Hello, Eva.
Hi, Pat. It's good to talk with you again.
Great to have you back, Eva. And we've been following your work online on social media, and you've got tremendous amount of information and interviews and a lot of different experiences that you've shared with people on social media. We've seen, and it's been looks like you've been pretty busy in Syria. You've arrived right on the tail end of quite a big event, Eva, and so, you know, things are still fresh there. I'm talking specifically about the supposed chemical weapons attack, so that supposedly happened in Douma, I believe, on April 7th or something like this. I'm not sure if I got the date right on that, but the airstrikes are on April 13th, which was Friday the 13th, that ominous day in April. And so I'm going to cut right to the chase. And firstly, hope you're well. How are you? And tell us about Douma. What really happened?
Yeah, thank you. I am well, and I'm in the midst of plodding through 3 weeks' worth of documentation from various parts of Syria, and, of course, translating and then eventually subtitling it. A number of videos and testimonies I took in eastern Ghouta, in Aleppo, in southern Syria. So I have a lot of work to do to get all the facts, you know, down on paper, but I can tell you the basics. In Douma, I went on the first Sunday that I was in Syria, a few weeks ago, I went to Douma, and I went to the hospital in question, the one that is shown, the one where people are shown being hosed down in one of the videos alleging that the Syrian government used chemical weapons. And it was definitely the same hospital. You can see the coloring on the walls and the hose that was used to hose down alleged victims, including Hassan Diab, that young boy that testified that he was not actually gassed but was given treats to be in the video. I, of course, didn't get to speak with Hassan Diab, but I did speak with a medical student, Marwan Jabber, who was in the hospital at the time that victims, alleged victims, started coming into the hospital. And he said that while he wasn't in the room the moment they came in, he did come into the room shortly after. And he basically said that the people that brought them in were not from the area. They were strangers. And in his opinion, they didn't have medical training, didn't really know what they were doing medically. And we know now, others before me have already spoken about this, but that they were shouting about chemical weapons. People started panicking. He said, of course, there was shelling happening because this is a war. There was shelling happening, and that when shelling happens, they often get cases of people coming in with breathing problems and people with asthmatic symptoms or just regular breathing problems. People also that people had been staying in their basements due to the shelling, and so they were having health issues related to being in dank basements for long periods of time. But he definitively said he did not see any sort of people suffering from reactions due to a chemical weapon attack. And he also made the point that none of these staff, doctors, nurses, and other staff on hand that day suffered from treating these people, which would have been the case you would expect if they were, in fact, treating people that had been doused with some sort of toxic chemical. They themselves were not wearing protective gear, so if it was actually a toxic chemical, then they would have had secondary effects, but none of them had any issues. And he also said none of the people that were brought into that hospital died in the hospital. So clearly, at least that part of the story that we have been told has been nullified by the testimonies of this man, other doctors, that people who went there prior to me, their testimonies, and of course the people that testified outside, I can't remember if it was in Geneva or where it was, but the people that testified, or maybe The Hague, that testified outside of Syria, giving their own accounts. The hospital also, it wasn't actually a hospital, it was a field hospital. I believe it was an agricultural building before that. It was buttressed with sandbags and earth, and it had, people know by now, it had this amazing tunnel system below ground that could not have been built simply in the last couple of years. I mean, it was a very, it's certainly not built, in my opinion, in the opinion of others who have seen this system, not built by just locals trying to escape the bombings. It was very well-crafted, very long tunnels, very wide tunnels, and I walked a segment, like, for 5 minutes, maybe a kilometer, of the tunnel. And so these were very well-designed tunnels, and that's an important aspect. They were leading from the field hospital to other areas, and they were, of course, means for terrorists to be underground and escape being shelled, as the Syrian army was targeting terrorists. But also in Douma, I had the chance just to walk along one of the main streets where there are a lot of, like a market area, where there's a lot of shops open, vendors of vegetables and fruits, and speak with the people one-on-one. I do speak Arabic, so I could understand what they were saying, but I also had a translator, and I also recorded everything so that I can accurately translate what they had to say. But they spoke of life under the rule of the terrorists there, and the fact that they were deprived of food, just like we saw in eastern Aleppo, just like I saw in Madaya. They were deprived of food due to the terrorists. I did ask, wherever I went in Ghouta, I asked if people had interacted with the White Helmets, if the White Helmets had been saving them. And I either got a straightforward answer that, no, they only saw the White Helmets working with the terrorists, or that they didn't know anything about them because they hadn't been allowed to go near them, which is very strange given that we're told that the White Helmets were mixing with civilians and saving civilians. And people, not just in Douma, but I also went to Kafr Batna and I also went to Sakba, all areas of eastern Ghouta. And I got that same reply, those same replies from people in each of those areas, which is not surprising given what we know about the White Helmets. And so, in other words, in terms of the other areas I went to, I know that Vanessa Beely also went to Sakba, and perhaps you guys talked about the White Helmet Center there, but I'll just briefly summarize that there was a two-building White Helmets complex in Sakba, and it was literally 200 meters or less down a lane from a bomb-making factory, manufacturing munitions from mortars to larger bombs and missiles. So clearly the White Helmets were working with terrorists in that area as well. And my interest in going to, what was the third place? Oh, Kafr Batna, was related to the allegations of a chemical attack in 2013, because Adam Larson of A Closer Look on Syria has done a lot of research with other people looking into the films that were shown to the public at the time of the alleged August 2013 alleged chemical weapons attacks. And so they finally deduced that one of the hospitals that was allegedly treating victims was in Kafr Batna. So I went there, and I was able to talk with the hospital administrator, who was on staff at the time in question, but he wasn't in the hospital the night in question. But he relayed to me what he had been told by doctors who were on staff, and he said essentially in the middle of the night, hundreds of alleged victims were brought into this hospital, and a great number of children from surrounding areas, surrounding villages in eastern Ghouta, were brought into the hospital. None of them were actually showing, according to him, according to doctors he's relaying the information from, none of them were showing, at the time they were brought in, were showing any symptoms of gassing. So what happened to them, we still don't know exactly what happened. There were reports of mass burials of children being buried alive and adults being buried alive. I didn't hear that firsthand. I heard that from citizens in eastern Ghouta areas relaying what they had heard. So, of course, that needs to be probed. I know that Vanessa Beely did get a testimony from people in one of the villages she visited in eastern Ghouta to the effect that children and other people were buried alive. So that's certainly something that we need to look into more. But the hospital in Kafr Batna was, I'm positive it was the one, tuberculosis hospital, I'm positive it was the one that was in at least one of the 2013 videos, because the room aligns with scenes in the videos. And there was also a tunnel system underneath that hospital. So it's becoming a common theme is in these areas where terrorists are operating under the guise of being rebels, bringing freedom and democracy. They have very sophisticated tunnel networks to keep them safe while they basically kept civilians hostage.
And just quickly, Eva, regarding Eastern Ghouta, I think it's really important you brought that up because, of course, that's part of the story of the Western narrative of Assad's using chemical weapons against his own people. August 2013, Parliament in the UK nearly passed a vote to, you know, bomb Syria effectively. And, of course, the United States, the Obama administration would have followed suit had that happened, but it didn't. But Petri Cohn, Caustic Logic, I believe he's a colleague of Adam Larson, at A Closer Look on Syria, released quite a provocative video looking at this and used the same exact footage that 60 Minutes used. I don't know if you saw this video that they put out a few months ago. And it shows that there are people on the ground purporting to be presented as chemical weapons victims with their throats slit, with the blood hemorrhaging from the top of their head. Clearly, these aren't people who were in a chemical weapons attack. This is something else, Eva. Did you happen to see that video? And is that the same location that you visited?
Yes, I did actually see the video. I didn't know that Petri was involved in that, but yes, Adam Larson had forwarded it, and I did see that video. It's quite grim. You see more than one. You see, if I remember, at least three, maybe five people who have clearly had a throat or head injury. So it's illogical to think that they were gassed to death when they were bleeding after the fact. And that was the hospital in question, because when I look at the video and look at the tiling and the coloring in the hospital that I visited, it is the same. And even there were two rooms. I remember that video. In analyzing the video, they dubbed the top floor the sun morgue and the bottom floor the dark morgue, I believe. The bottom floor was where those bodies would have been laid out. And the top, let me double check that. No, I'm sorry. I'm not 100% sure about that. Now I'm trying to remember. Because the top floor, what they dubbed the sun morgue, is now a room with walls blown out. But actually, that would have been the one where the bodies were laid out, because there you can see in the video these square pillars in the room, and that correlates to the room that I saw with the walls blown out. But it is a room where cars or other vehicles bringing people to the hospital, that would have been the first room they accessed unless they went around the hospital to the back. So it is logical that that was the room that was used in the video in question.
Yes, and a striking video. We'll try to repost that up at 21st Century Wire, and hopefully either after the show or on Monday. But back to Douma, you know, this whole story, even, I'm sure you followed this closely as it was breaking, as many people did. The source of the information of this alleged chemical attack, everything is basically coming from two sources that I can see, and that is the SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society, who Ken Roth's wife works with, by the way. Ken Roth, the director of Human Rights Watch, who is very anti-Syria and pro-regime change. His wife is very closely working with SAMS for years now, and also the White Helmets, who call themselves Syria Civil Defense. Of course, they've stolen that name from the actual civil defense in Syria, and they've ripped off the name and then have a sort of secondary brand moniker of the White Helmets. They provided the video. They provided the press release. So this is where all the information comes from. And the British officials are saying that, well, of course, Assad must have done it because he needed to launch a chemical weapons attack to get Jaish al-Islam to surrender, because otherwise they wouldn't have surrendered, and this is a tactic Assad uses over and over again. So I think you know the story very well, Eva. But, I mean, is there not even an attempt to present any actual evidence? And we heard about blood samples that the French secretly received, and we've seen CNN up at the refugee camps in Idlib or Turkey with all the hundreds or thousands of survivors from this brutal chemical attack. What do you think about all this, and are you able to break any of that down?
Well, I mean, in 2013, Mint Press News actually was the first that I'm aware of that actually did a very interesting report debunking the allegations of the 2013 alleged chemical attacks, and saying, in fact, they said, in fact, the so-called rebels were guilty. And I don't remember the specifics of the article. I could certainly find it and send it to you. But I remember they sent, and I spoke with the Mint Press editor, Manar Mahawish, recently when I was in New York, and she said, we sent, I believe it was two journalists to the area in question. They were able to speak with some of these so-called rebels who admitted that they had these weapons that they weren't familiar with. And so, I mean, the 2013 attacks, just like the recent allegations, and just like Han Shikun, always the timing is so questionable. In the case of 2013, it was, I believe, the eve before weapons inspectors arrived in Syria. In the case of the allegations of 2018, it was when the Syrian army had been able to eradicate terrorism in almost, I believe, over 80% of Douma. So, you know, just when the terrorists are on their last limbs, that we're meant to believe the Syrian army used chemical weapons, when, as others have pointed out before me, the Syrian army have members of their families in Eastern Ghouta. So it is illogical to think that they're as crazy and sadistic as terrorists who will fire upon areas where their loved ones are. But the Syrian army, why would they want to use chemical weapons when the people they care about are living in those areas? That's just one. I mean, the other one is, as Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, has said in a few interviews, use your brain, you know, make your brain work. It's illogical to think that the Syrian government would even want to, knowing what the repercussions of using chemical weapons would be. But then when we think about the what followed these alleged attacks, and also, pardon me, but it was following a week following when Trump had said they would start pulling the U.S. out of Syria. So it's really logical and credible to think that the Syrian government decided the best thing to do on that news was to sabotage itself. But following that, then the U.S. response was to say, we have evidence, and that was, like you said, SAMS, which is completely U.S. State Department aligned, and the White Helmets and other such trustworthy media, and then to launch an attack on Syria, one of whose targets was a laboratory in Berzeh, Damascus. So if we're meant to believe that the Syrian government, even though the body that investigates chemical weapons, the OPCW had already, as Ambassador Jaffrey noted in one of the UN sessions, had already in recent years, if not last year, issued two separate papers or notices saying that they deemed this factory clear of chemical weapons. So that aside, If we actually believe that the this laboratory in Berzeh possessed toxic chemical weapons, then doesn't it seem illogical to bomb it when it's in a densely inhabited area of Damascus? So, I mean, all these things, it's quite clear the U.S. is grasping at straws, not just the U.S., but their allies, and they're recycling this very tired chemical weapons story that I would hope more and more people are waking up to the fact that now they've never had any evidence. And to the contrary, there has been much evidence, like Khan al-Assal in 2012 and Ghouta in 2013, at least, that the terrorists had the means and ability to perpetrate such an attack.
Mm-hmm. And right, you know, this is amazing, too. There's so many of these reports, but the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom is running point on what really kind of it's beginning to be more obvious as kind of propaganda to reinforce the sort of U.S. U.K. narratives on all of these wild and fantastic claims. So the Guardian put out a story on April 17th. Okay, this is like 4 days after the airstrike, and it was basically their report on the Douma atrocity, as they called it. And so they're claiming that there were medics and survivors who remained in Douma. But everyone else had fled to northern Syria. And so they ridiculed any claims that the attack did not take place or that there was no gas used. And so apparently these medics and survivors who remained in Douma, how did the Guardian talk to them? Well, apparently this was all done through their reporters in Istanbul and Beirut. So they didn't have anybody on the ground. And yet they're claiming that these people, they're claiming there's medics and survivors in Douma. And this ran, and nobody questioned this at the time. And there's just so much shoddy journalism. I'm going to say that the Guardian is fabricating. This looks to me like a classic fabricated report. Because there is no way to confirm what you're looking at there. In fact, there are journalists who came in after that, like Robert Fisk, who is one of the probably most prolific award-winning war reporters, maybe in British history, possibly. And he was on the ground in Douma, and what he said refutes this Guardian report, and so many others have as well. And Robert Fisk was maligned. He's been trolled. He's been called all sorts of names, insulted, basically just completely disowned by the wider media establishment. Why? Because the facts that he came up with, they somehow veered away, or they contravened the official government, UK-US government story on this. And so it's hard to know where to start, but I think we need to call out some of these mainstream media outlets. I think they're producing propaganda by the looks of it, Eva. My own assessment. No, I'm not alone, by the way.
Well, I mean, Robert Fisk is like the last person that one could call an Assad apologist.
And yes.
apologist, because he makes quite clear his distaste for the Syrian government. So the fact that he was on the ground talking to, I believe it was the doctor, the main doctor, one of the doctors in the Douma hospital, and then also talking with civilians on the street, and he refutes their evidence and also happens to be very anti-Syrian government, and yet The Guardian goes ahead and maligns him. That does show how clear their agenda is. I mean, and this, of course, follows their personal attacks on Vanessa Beeley and myself, and I believe on yourself. Mm-hmm. And their staunch defense of the white helmets, their unwillingness to even question whether this entity could be more than, could be other than what it is portrayed as. And of course, you know, The Guardian's George Monbiot has also participated in quite crass personal attacks, especially on Vanessa Beeley. So they've certainly, I have no idea what's up with The Guardian. I mean, certainly not a paper that I would donate a coffee's worth to. But they're not alone. Huffington Post, which is, I don't know what kind of readership they have, but they've been busy getting in on the act of character assassinations instead of doing actual journalism. But you have so many now independent journalists, in addition to Robert Fisk, who is with the Independent, in addition to Syrian and Russian journalists who first reported it. Now you have all these people corroborating it, and the corporate media is refusing to even question the official narrative. And that speaks volumes about the corporate media's agenda.
Sure. And just quickly, you know, almost all of their claims, actually, the Guardian anyway, are based on information from the White Helmets, who themselves were told they fled to Turkey somehow on the buses that were sending the jihadists, their families, and supporters, I guess, up to Idlib or wherever they were shipped off to. The White Helmets apparently hitched a ride there. And so it's not really a credible source. Would you agree with me that the brand of the White Helmets is really damaged worldwide, I think? How do you see that in terms of how people view them? And, you know, you talk to people, Eva, who don't follow the news, probably, you know, when you're out in the field and you're traveling, who don't follow the news as closely. They don't know all the ins and outs, but they probably have heard something or read something or expressed doubt about the White Helmets. How are you hearing that?
Well, I actually don't have a sense of what the public opinion is on the White Helmets. I do get a lot of messages thanking me, although I think that thanks is misattributed, because certainly Vanessa's done by far the deepest and most in-depth research into the White Helmets, and of course Corey Morningstar before her. But I do get a lot of people messaging and saying, you know, they were duped at first, but now they see quite clearly what the White Helmets really are. And you know, given the fact that wherever areas are liberated and White Helmets have had centers, they're inevitably always next to Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Like, for example, the one in Saqqaa, as I mentioned, I believe that was Failaq al-Rahman. And by the way, that munitions factory I mentioned, those mortars would have been used to fire on Damascus civilians. And I think that's an important point to note, because our media never was talking about the at least 10,000 civilians that were murdered by these freedom-loving terrorists when they fired missiles and mortars on Damascus for years. And when the media was pulling the last doctor and save the civilians of Ghouta stunt, they didn't rejoice in the fact that now people in Damascus are free, almost free, of the reign of terror of missiles and mortars. There are still missiles and mortars coming from Yarmouk and Hajar al-Aswad, but liberating Ghouta was a significant step in bringing peace and stability back to Damascus. I went to Aleppo this trip, and I was interested to see what life was like. Even though I had been there last summer my focus was, well, on Omran Dakhmish and meeting his family and his father and hearing his story, and going to, you know, the eye hospital complex that had been occupied by terrorists and the basements of which had been turned into prisons to try civilians in Sharia courts. So I didn't actually have time in my trip last year to go to areas like the Citadel, but this time I did, and I was amazed at the pulse of life there. But I also, I talked with Pierre Lecorf, and I know you've had him on your show, and if listeners don't know who he is, I really, really encourage them to look him up on Facebook. It's Pierre Lecorf with an F. And he's been there for years now in Aleppo doing amazing work with youths especially. And I had a chance to talk with him about their, you know, how they're dealing with life now post-liberation. But also, and I put some videos up from that Aleppo visit so people can check out what Pierre had to say, but also to go with Khaled Iskaif, the wonderful Syrian journalist in Aleppo, to the White Helmets complex in Ansari, and to see again, just like in Sokhba, it was literally next door to Al-Qaeda and other terrorist factions in that district of Aleppo. And Khaled also pointed out that just down the road, like less than 50 meters from the White Helmets building, which was a school they occupied, and the school is now being used as it should be used by children as in school, but just down the road from there was the point where Nuruddin Azinki executed Abdullah Issa. So again, everywhere we find White Helmet centers, and I know you've visited some yourself, we can see they're in bed with the terrorists that are attacking civilians. So if that myth of the White Helmet is not dead for other people, I don't know what it takes to wake them up, because it's beyond clear now that they do not have civilians in mind, fleeing to Idlib with terrorists and burning valuable equipment, fire trucks and ambulances, as they did in Sokhba. What kind of rescuers do this thing?
Well, that's a good question. It's these aren't first responders, and I think the thing I always come back to, Eva, is they claim at one point, I believe some of them were claiming to have saved 100,000 lives since they came on the scene in 2013. Then that figure kind of got dropped down to like 90, and then they even dropped it down to 70. It might be back up to 100 again. But that kind of yo-yos up and down, of course. But you know, they're claiming they saved 70,000 lives and they're first responders. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars, Eva, from the UK government, from the US government combined, from all the EU member states, from as far afield as Japan, I believe. Hundreds of millions of dollars. Wouldn't a legitimate or a real first responder or search and rescue outfit, wouldn't they take the names and fill out accident reports, or at least keep some records of the people who they are supposedly rescuing, the names, the addresses, the parents' names of all these thousands of children? We've seen the videos they continually produce. I don't think there's any record to validate these astronomical numbers, which they have, they're claiming that they've rescued all these 100,000 people, I guess, at the highest. Eva, it just comes back to basics, really. What sort of organization are they?
Yeah, I don't know about their records. Maybe they burned the records when they burned the vehicles. I really don't know. But I know that at least in areas I've been to, terrorists were meticulous in keeping records of the people they imprisoned, of their own members of terrorist organizations. So you'd assume if the White Helmets were rescuing people, they would also be meticulous. And like you said, it is standard practice for doctors, for hospitals to keep a record of patients, their intake patients. So that's a very good question, and I wonder if the Guardian has ever produced any of these records, since they are so staunchly defending the white helmets. But I was going through my notes, and I found when I was talking to a group of men and youths, like teens, at a vegetable vendor in Douma, I was asking about the white helmets, and I did find one of their replies, and they said, during the last days, people used to die, and they, meaning the white helmets, never aided anyone. We never saw them. That happened a lot. The white helmets are called civil defense. They were supposedly for the civilians, but they were the contrary. They were for the army, the Himat Jaish al-Islam. He said something like, whether in medicine or the whole medical staff, they neglected the whole people. And just reiterated that they work with Jaish al-Islam. And this is just a normal, like, this isn't a government official. This is just a normal person on the street in Douma.
Sure. Yeah. And one of the things that's amazing is, I also come back to the fact that almost all of the videos that they produce, they're all shot pretty much the same way. This is exact same sequence of events. A van rolls up, the door opens, they run out, they've got the helmet cam on, and they run by sort of men and a series of men who are looking at them and kind of in the way. And then they run and they meet somebody who almost always has a baby or a child in hand. And then that child is handed to them, and then it's passed on to another person. I can't count how many videos I've seen they've produced that are pretty much the same. It's identical, basically. And it just kind of really smacks of being completely staged. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. Other people have commented on this as well, but I don't know. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
All the yellas, yella, 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 yella. I mean, I know yella is one of the most used, aside from Habibi, words in Arabic-speaking areas. But as I said in another interview, I did work with rescuers in Gaza. And I wasn't a rescuer, but I was documenting the Israeli war crimes. And so I was riding in ambulances. And I swear to God, they did not behave like this. They were focused on their work. Yes, they communicated, but there's so much jabbering going on in the White Helmets videos, unnecessary jabbering, and of course all the religious utterances they utter. Like, I never, and Gaza is a very devout area too, so they are religious, and it's not like they don't know the vocabulary, but the point is they were just too busy doing their work. And really, like, if you just don't look at the video, just listen to the jabbering in the White Helmets videos, and you'll see how comical it is. They really do seem to be acting, or for some reason uttering a whole lot of jabbering that is unnecessary. It's irrelevant to their actual supposed rescue work.
Yeah, the religious utterances are quite extraordinary as well. But, well, you know, as that unravels quickly, the question is, I guess the last question with the white helmets is, where do they have left to operate in Syria? Because are they not running out of places where they can sort of operate? I'm sure the Kurds don't want them in northeastern Syria, in the U.S.-occupied bit. I don't think they're welcome anywhere else in Syria. Are they in? Do you think they are in Daraa, or do you think they're all in Idlib, or have they just scuttled off to Turkey?
I can't speak definitively about that. I think that I saw something about them, a video of theirs from Daraa, but I don't know 100%. But I am glad that you mentioned Daraa, because that is something I'd like to address since I was recently there.
Oh, absolutely. So you went to Daraa. A lot of people believe, Eva, that if there's going to be another sort of staged chemical attack or another provocation like we saw in Douma, it will happen there. It will happen in Daraa, or it will happen in Idlib. So you traveled down past Sweida to Daraa, down to the south. Were you there on this last trip?
Yeah, so I actually, Sweida's further to the southeast. Daraa's almost straight south from Damascus, maybe slightly west. I'd have to look at the map again. But yeah, I did go there, it's about 4 days ago now. And the reason I was interested in going there is because we're told, well, you and I had a conversation about this once when we met up in Lebanon. Some people, or many people perhaps, really believed that things kicked off in Dara and that this was the birthplace of the so-called revolution. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, they believed the official narrative spouted by Western talking heads and their lapdog media that the so-called revolution was peaceful for the first, I don't know, some people say 6 months, some people say a year. But many people, Professor Tim Anderson, Sharmeen Narwani, other valued journalists have written about events in Dara and how there were armed people amongst the protesters from the very beginnings, from March 2011. And in one of my visits in summer 2016, I interviewed a soldier and he told his account of what happened. He was sent there and the violence that he and the 300 other soldiers and I think it was 500 police encountered at the hands of protesters who were armed and firing on them, and they did not have arms. But I was interested in actually going there and trying to speak with other people that could corroborate this story. So first, before I went to Dara, some days before that, I met a doctor, Dr. Amer Ransous, and he was a doctor in the field hospital, the military hospital in Dara, about 40 kilometers from the city of Dara. And what he had to say, I haven't had a chance to put his interview up because I literally just left Syria, so I've got a lot of things to do sifting through my notes, but essentially some of the more important things of what he had to say was the manipulation of the media, notably Al Jazeera in that time, and that's actually, I have to say, also the soldier I interviewed, he also cited Al Jazeera, saying that he later saw Al Jazeera airing footage of Dara of March 2011, and he knew exactly that was from March 2011, but it was later aired in May or later, with Al Jazeera saying this is happening now in Dara. But with regards to Dr. Ransous, what he said was he was on staff in the military hospital, and before the next Friday of protest in March 2011, he said that a general briefed the hospital staff, specifically instructing them to give priority to civilians. So if civilians and or soldiers came into the hospital for treatment, they were to treat civilians first. This is a top-down order. Now, one of the lies that Al Jazeera spouted was they were saying that the hospital was denying treatment to civilians, and this is categorically false, according to Dr. Amer. He also said there were so many doctors on staff that he didn't have anything to do, and he consequently was sitting drinking coffee, watching the news, watching Al Jazeera, and seeing their lies. Because another of the lies was to say that there was not enough doctors on staff. So first they say they were rejecting civilians, and then they say there were no doctors in the hospital. And it was definitely the hospital he was at and not another one, because he said he also saw footage being streamed live from one of the hospital rooms, which begs the question, in March 2011, who had the technology to be live streaming from a hospital in Dara? I certainly, with a Samsung Galaxy 7 and the Syrian I had internet data, but I don't think I could have streamed with the phone I had. And I just wonder, the average citizen in Dara, what kind of phone they had that enabled them to live stream from that hospital. And I would suspect the answer is they had a pretty high-tech gadget that most civilians didn't have. But in any case, what was the third lie? He said that soldiers were being brought in, and they were being brought in with sniper wounds. And that correlates to the story, or the investigations, I should say, of Tim Anderson and many other journalists who said, having investigated what was being reported by Syrians and by Syrians on the ground, that there were snipers amongst the crowd that were firing at security forces. Now, when I went to Dara, one of the people I spoke with was a priest, Father Georges Rizik. And he gave a fantastically informative interview. And some of the highlights of that interview was speaking from his own experience. He said, "We saw the protesters shooting at one another to blame the government." He also mentioned having seen people coming from the countryside of Dara on motorcycles, sitting on their weapons to try to disguise them, to smuggle them in. He said one of the churches was targeted. This was later on in 2013. But he said that terrorists waited until people were in church for prayers, for mass, and then they targeted them to target Christians. He did hear the sectarian slander that we've heard Syrians have reported, saying protesters saying Alawis to the grave and Christians to Beirut. Mm-hmm. And he said, regarding the media lies, he said, frankly, we know the truth. We lived it. We live in it. And we don't care what you believe. We know what we have lived. And if you're going to lie, we don't care because we know what the truth is. And he also, he said, problems started also with clerics. I believe he was referring to Muslim clerics in Dara that were trying to encourage all religious clerics to take a position against the government. And he said he himself got a call from one of these so-called rebels, although he didn't specify the date, asking or calling upon him to take an anti-Syrian government position. And he said that would necessitate him leaving his church, his family, because the government was protecting him and his family. So those, that was just one of many interesting testimonies. I also got testimonies from a sheikh in Dara, from people who had been injured by terrorist attacks, people talking about attacks on churches. And then I was able to go to a school that has been badly damaged, and it was literally 150 meters away from the terrorist front line. So getting to that school is dangerous for school children. Going past it is dangerous for civilians because they're literally in the line of sniper fire. And further along on the road that would eventually lead to the state hospital, that was also a very dangerous road because at the end of that road, 150 meters off, were more snipers. And this is interesting because on that road also there was a private hospital and that had been closed due to intense shelling from terrorist factions. And I was told by a local from Dara that 40 people at least had been killed on that road through shelling and sniping from terrorists. And the hospital itself, which you can only access by going down a lane that is very dangerous because of the risk of being sniped. So needless to say, the car I was in was gunning down the lane to get to the hospital. The hospital itself has been badly damaged by shelling, terror shelling, and by sniping. So they have entire wards that are off limits now. They can't reach their children's hospital or children's ward, their gynecology ward, where the operations room was. They can't reach because of the risk of sniping. And also they have a pharmacy there that they can't reach because to reach it, you have to pass through a sniping area. So, you know, this is a hospital we would think with all the concern the West professes and the Western media professes for civilians in hospital, why aren't they talking about this hospital? And obviously my question is rhetorical because it doesn't suit their narrative. This hospital and the civilians trying to reach it are being terrorized by the groups that the West are funding or whitewashing.
Yes, and I don't know if you saw that, you know, we're constantly told that it started off as peaceful protests in Dara and across Syria. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Eva, I mean, I'm pretty sure that in the initial Dara protest, they burned down the judiciary courthouse building downtown, the demonstrators, if you will, and the sniping as well, which is a gray area that a lot of people don't want to sort of interrogate. They automatically want to blame that on the government shooting peaceful protesters. And so I think that's really important work you're doing there. But I don't think these were peaceful protests in Dara starting out. I think it was very violent, in fact, from the beginning. So this is part of the mythology that's used to sort of build the story. Go ahead.
Well, exactly. I mean, so first I had, from 2 years ago, I had the testimony of the soldier that was sent to Dara and that came under fire from these so-called peaceful protesters 3 Fridays in a row. And now testimonies from civilians, including also this priest, that was there saying, no, there were snipers and there were armed people among the protesters shooting on one another, shooting on protesters to incriminate the Syrian government. So, I mean, I also have, and this will take some time to plow through, but I have the records of the one of the Ba'ath Party leaders in Dara kept the records for 1 year, so from early 2011 to at some point 2012, of the various crimes committed by so-called protesters. And it's a pretty thick book, so crimes including assassinations. So that will be very informative, I think. And I also have a DVD given to me by a journalist there with also, you know, documentation of these different crimes. So I think there's a lot of information to glean from that. But I also, when I was there, I asked about Hans al-Khatib, who was, we were told, he was beaten to death by security forces. And I had heard some years ago from another person that, in fact, you know, he was killed in crossfire, and there were, I believe, 3 bullet holes in his abdomen and chest, and he was not beaten to death. And the person that told me that said he had actually seen the coroner's report and seen a photo of Khatib after his death, and there was no bruising. When I was in Dara, I had this repeated to me, not about the coroner's report, but that Khatib was amongst a group of people. Whether he was participating or not, this person didn't specify, but he was amongst a group of people that were firing on security forces who then returned fire. So that's another, you know, chipping away at the mythology of how things actually began in Syria and in Dara specifically.
Yeah, it's very important that this story comes out and has done so with rigorous research and detail, because I'll tell you, Eva, they're teaching this in classes and universities all over the world. This is part of the curriculum now, the peaceful protests that were brutally put down by the dictator Bashar al-Assad. That is how most people in the West are being taught. That's the foundational narrative of this Syrian so-called civil war. And Dara is a really, really key part of that. So, you know, it's very important work. So, you know, we completely support, you know, your efforts there. But we're just going to wrap up in a couple of minutes. But there's a lot of other things that I'm sure you can share with us. I mean, one of them is, what's it like in Damascus, Eva, when there's not continuous mortar fire? I know they're still getting incoming from Yarmouk and some of these other last remaining ISIS strongholds, for instance. But what's it like being able to? Were you able to walk through the old city of Damascus without, you know, without that sort of fear of incoming mortars or rockets?
Yeah, like you said, there are still mortars and missiles landing on areas like Midan, closer to Yarmouk or Hajar al-Aswad. But Damascus, I mean, because, Patrick, I was on my visits to Syria over the years, for example, especially in 2014, the mortars were incessant throughout the day. It was nonstop mortaring. And also on visits in 2015 and 2016, not quite as hard as I experienced in 2014, but still, nonetheless, at any day, you know, there could be a mortar, and there were mortars targeting civilians, schools, marketplaces, etc. I made a point of asking people I was encountering as I was waiting to go other places in Syria. I walked around Damascus and was talking to people about how they felt, and of course it was relief. But they said prior to the liberation of Ghouta that the number of mortars and the intensity really ramped up, and it was horrible, horrifying. But now, I mean, it was an amazing atmosphere, really, just to know that people didn't have to fear at some moment whether they're kids were walking home from school or whether they were sitting at an indoor or outdoor cafe. They didn't have to fear any longer being mortared.
Yeah.
But there is one more issue, and we don't maybe have time to get into, but I would like to at least refer people to look at the Facebook page of Mahmoud Tawil, who is from the village of Hadar in Kunaitra. And I did have a chance to go visit him, and just in sum, that village has been targeted by al-Nusra, another terrorist, for years, and together with the Syrian Arab Army, they've defended themselves from being invaded by these terrorists. But the terrorists have had the backing of Israel, of course, which has outposts, observation posts on the mountains overlooking the entire district. But, I mean, if people go to Mahmoud al-Tawil's Facebook page, I would encourage you to follow and support him, because Hadar is still potentially being attacked. And he's even posted recently about being in periods of darkness and about what the people in Hadar are facing. So when I talked with people, they were, I believe it was offhand, I think it was at least 130 people in that village were killed. And it's only a village of around 10,000 people. So it's another area of Syria that's been out of the media spotlight because the people are suffering at the hands of the terrorists, which we support.
Yeah, drop us on the social media chat or after we leave you here, and I will post that on the show page for this episode, so people will be able to click through and find out more about that issue. So we really appreciate that. But that's all we have on this segment, Eva. But you know, great work as usual, and everyone out here appreciates your efforts and what you're dedicated to doing, which is really telling the full and truthful story about one of the longest, dirtiest wars of our times. And this is the war on Syria, and so we very much appreciate it. And you're a voice for truth, and you're a great representative of the independent media, as it's informally known. But thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Pat. And I will have more videos coming out as I sit and sift through them and get them subtitled. So I'll try to prioritize getting some of the English ones out sooner from Mahmoud and from the doctor that I mentioned who was in Dara. But thanks a lot for having me on so early after having left Syria.
That's great. And take care. Safe travels. Eva Bartlett, hope to speak to you soon.
Great. Thanks.
There she goes, ladies and gentlemen. That's Eva Bartlett, independent journalist, just off an extended fact-finding trip, an investigative trip inside Syria. You can see her work at her website, which is In Gaza and Beyond. There's a link to it on the show page. Now keep an eye on Eva's work. You can also follow her on Twitter and on Facebook as well. So we have links to those on the show page as well. We'll get more links up before the end of the show. But we're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to connect with our next guest, Robert Inlakesh. He's going to join us after the break. So stick around. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. This is the Sunday Wire. We'll be right back.
Something's got to change. After the rain now, things just can't stay the same. No, right now, something's got to change. After the rain now, things just can't stay the same.